It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about some words that have disappeared from the English language.
First, as things currently stand in Wisconsin, if someone dies as a result of excessive force from a police officer, that death is investigated with the police department itself.
But under a new bill that is set for a vote in the state assembly tomorrow, that could change. Representatives Gary Bies of Sister Bay and Chris Taylor of Madison have sponsored legislation that would turn that investigation over to an outside agency.
While the bill has support from statewide police organizations, members of the City of Milwaukee government have pushed back, saying reforms are unnecessary, even as the Milwaukee Police Department has been criticized recently for using excessive force. Here to talk about the bill is Representative Chris Taylor of Madison. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start by putting this into context. How common is it to see the use of excessive force by Wisconsin law enforcement?
Well, you know, in just the last year here in Madison, we have had three officer-involved deaths. So the issue is really about that, is when is it appropriate to use deadly force? And in our own community here, we have seen an increase in the use of deadly force against civilians. So that really kind of inspired this bill.
Yeah, can you share with us some of the stories that spurred the creation?
Well, there's been probably the best-known incidents, unfortunately, that occurred is one that is not at all far from my home, and that was the death of Paul Heenan, who was an unarmed civilian, kind of strange circumstance, but he was intoxicated. It was very early in the morning, went into the wrong home, and without walking back to his home with his neighbor when he was shot by a police officer who was called to the scene. And that ended in there is no criminal charges being brought against the officer. The officer, though, did end up resigning based on some other allegations that came out after this incident. So the officer did not ever return to law enforcement. But that was an incident that really shook up my community. I think the other kind of horrific incident happened in Milwaukee, and that involved Derek Williams, who was the man who was apprehended on suspicion of committing a crime that he did not commit, and he had a condition, he had an asthma attack and ended up suffocating in the back of the police car. So I think that the time really is right to look at how these incidents are investigated, and I think, and I know that my co-author, Representative Bies, really thought that it would be much better for the public, and I think better for law enforcement, to get to a more independent, more transparent process in how these incidents are investigated.
Well, how are they investigated right now as it stands?
It's agency by agency, but for the most part, you have agencies investigating their own officers. So you could have very easily a colleague of the officer involved or someone who worked with the officer quite closely actually doing the investigation into whether the officer committed a crime, which, you know, at its best, I think raises a perception of bias. And I think at the worst does raise the issue of bias. But currently it's kind of an agency by agency determination. This bill would really set a framework and say that the lead investigator cannot be from the agency where the officer accused of being involved with the officer in the death was employed. And it also would require an additional investigator to be from another agency. So really, the bill is trying to get to a more impartial, more independent model of how these investigations are done.
So you're describing a team of two that would not be internal. They'd be from an outside agency. Are you worried at all that an outside perspective like that might not have the depth of knowledge and just sort of the knowledge of the lay of the land that someone on the inside may have?
Well, you know, we crafted the bill to allow a lot of flexibility for the agency, so we're not dictating who it should be. We want to make sure that anything we're imposing on law enforcement, that it's going to work for them. And so the issue of who it actually is left to that particular agency. So I don't see any reason why that agency wouldn't pick somebody who's very experienced in doing this. But we do leave that decision to the individual agency, and the bill just says you have to get an investigator from another agency. So, you know, I think in general it's a real improvement. You could argue that, well, maybe this person won't have the experience, but hopefully the agency will solicit someone who does, And I think it lends an impartiality that currently is just not present in how these investigations are done.
There's been mixed response to the bill. It has gotten support from the Police Association and the Sheriff's Association, but officials in Milwaukee have said that they don't think the reforms are necessary because they think that the pathologists, the prosecutors, the law enforcement officers, that they all share a common goal, and that is to be fair and objective, and that there are already layers of oversight. What do you say to that?
Well, first of all, the bill has mostly, in fact, I haven't heard of anybody opposing this bill. It's supported by the police union. It's supported by the Badger Sheriff. The chief of police have withdrawn any concern they had about the bill. The advocates and families who've been involved are supporting the bill. So I haven't heard specifically that Milwaukee has any problems with this bill. In fact, I believe that Milwaukee's policy currently does comply with the bill, come really close to complying with the bill. So if they have a concern, it certainly has not reached my ears, nor do I believe it's been communicated to Representative Bies. We have worked really, really hard. This is now, we're on the third version of this bill, to make sure that we have a bill that has the buy-in from law enforcement, but also has the buy-in from the public and from advocates and families that have been so impacted by this issue.
Right. So I gather that the city of Milwaukee's position is listed as undisclosed, but those comments have come from officials within the city. And I guess regardless of what you've heard about those specific remarks, do you think there's anything to that, that the oversight is already there?
Well, you know, I think that they do have a process in Milwaukee that is relatively new. But Milwaukee has had some very, very egregious situations. I just talked about one, the Derrick Bell situation, which was a horrible instance where eventually a special prosecutor was called and there was a grand jury that was brought in, and they believe there were charges that should have been brought against the officers, and the special prosecutor refused to bring those charges. So, you know, if Milwaukee is complying with this, they shouldn't have anything to worry about. But everybody should be held in the state to the same standard. And that's really what this bill does, is say, look, you need to follow this framework. The framework gives a lot of flexibility, however. But everybody is going to be required to make sure an outside investigator is leading the investigation. And so I would hope that Milwaukee sees the value in this. And I do think, as I said, their policy is coming. It either complies or it's extremely close to complying with this state law.
I want to ask you a little bit more about Milwaukee. I understand a former version of the bill excluded Milwaukee from these reforms, and then it was put back in. Can you talk about why that was?
Sure. Well, you know, we were obviously, Representative Bies and myself, were working very diligently to craft something that law enforcement bought into. We didn't want to impose something on law enforcement that they did not think would work for them. And so we did toy with taking Milwaukee out completely. You know, that wasn't the best solution, though, in my opinion. We actually got everyone around a table once more and went back to the drawing board because there was a lot of people very unhappy about that, which I understood why. It kind of went back to some of the core principles that were in the original bill. And this language of requiring two outside investigators really was the core piece of the bill from the inception of the bill. And so we started again talking to law enforcement, and they thought that that was actually a much better option, and that was language that they could accept and that they thought was good, and advocates as well. So that's kind of how we got back to that language. Again, I'm really proud of this bill. I think this bill is a consensus bill. We have heard really positive things about it. We have law enforcement that is supporting or not opposing the bill at this point, and we have families and advocates who believe it's a good step forward. So I think we came up with something that really does address the needs of most of the voices that we were communicating and most of the people who were at the table.
Another issue that's been raised in Wisconsin is deaths and sometimes suicides of prisoners. Now, is that something you'd like to see looked at a little more closely as well?
Well, that is covered in the bill. So an officer-involved death is the death of an individual that results directly from an action or an omission of a law enforcement officer. So that is something that would be covered in this bill as well. But it does seem like we've seen more and more incidents of that occurring as well. So that is something that is included in the bill.
Of prisoners.
Right. It's anybody who is in the custody of law enforcement.
I see.
And so a prisoner would be in the custody of law enforcement. And because of an act or an omission of an act, there was a death that resulted. There's also, you know, the instance of these high-speed chases. That's another instance where we've had an incident in Madison where we had a high-speed chase that resulted in the person being chased, being hurt. So that is another instance that would be covered in the bill.
So this bill goes to a vote in the Assembly tomorrow. What are the prospects, do you think?
I think it's going to do really well, and it's going to pass, and I suspect we're going to see a lot of bipartisan support for this bill. I'm, of course, always optimistic. I'm hoping for an unanimous vote, so we'll see if we can get everybody, if we can get a unanimous vote. But I think it's going to, you know, receive a lot of support. People know that there's been a lot of discomfort with how officer-involved deaths are investigated. We're moving away from the internal investigation to a more of an unbiased, independent investigation. I think the time is right. We've had enough incidents of these officer-involved shootings and deaths that I think the public really is ready to move, and I think law enforcement is ready to look at an alternative model.
Representative Taylor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Representative Chris Taylor about her proposed legislation that would turn investigations of deaths in custody over to organizations outside the police department. That bill goes to a vote in the Assembly tomorrow. In the hour or two you set aside each day to ponder deep questions about the English language, do you ever find yourself wondering, why can we be inept but not ept? Why unkempt but not kempt? Well, you've stumbled on what language experts call unmatched pairs.
And it's true. I have been spending a couple hours a day pondering this every day. So we've got one of our favorite language experts with us today to help sort all of that out. Grant Barrett is a journalist, a lexicographer, and co-host of the public radio show Away With Words. Grant, welcome back.
Hello there.
Well, I want to start. You very thoughtfully, I have to say, for the purposes of this discussion, provided me with a short poem. I'm not going to read all of it, but it sort of outlines what we're talking about here with these unmatched words. And the poem, the first verse of it, is called A Very Descript Man, and give credit where credit is due. It was written by J.H. Parker, first printed in Collier's Magazine back in the 1940s. So here's the first verse. I am such a dolent man. I eptly work each day. My acts are all basilic. I've just ain't things to say. And so that sort of outlines what these words are like. It also demonstrates that this is an issue, if you can call it that, that's been around for quite some time.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have this kind of innate sense on the value of words that has something to do with things that aren't about their meaning or their definition. So we call this pragmatics in linguistics, where we have little flags attached to words. And with these particular words, we have a flag that says, I don't know the antonym. So big, we know the antonym is little is a good one for that, and happy and sad and fat and skinny and so forth. But if you say somebody is indolent, you're like struggling for its opposite number. What is its, who is its partner in language? You know, we're missing that. And you can start to slowly build this list over time and say, wait a second, I don't know what the opposite incognito is. Is it cognito? If I travel everywhere with my name on a badge, am I traveling cognito? I don't really know.
If you're kempt, unkempt, where did kempt go? Inept, are you apt?
Yeah.
And all those sorts of things. So I've heard this term lost positives. Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, that's the same thing, exactly. Or unmatched pairs, lost positives. And it all depends upon this very interesting thing about words. Each of them travels alone. They might be a part of a caravan, if we want to take this metaphor pretty far, but for the most part, their history is dependent upon accidents. So if you do have a pair of words like kempt or unkempt, unkempt has traveled well and has lasted and has been used, but kempt somehow doesn't exist anymore. Or if it does exist, it exists in a different form. Unkempt is super interesting because it's related to the word combed, as in I combed my hair. And what we have here, then, is this where the C traded for a K, where the T used for the past participle is actually an ED in the other word, the unvoiced P versus the voiced B, and there you have it. It kempt and combed are actually the same word etymologically. They both mean combed. But we just got the form kempt attached to unkempt and kept it. So it's this preserved archaism. It's a mosquito in amber, as it were.
So is there any move ever afoot to resurrect some of these words? Like, let's use kempt for a good example, as long as we're talking about that. Or is it once they're gone, they're never coming back?
Well, there are a lot of people like you and me and our listeners who do love to resuscitate these words, usually with a little bit of a joke in mind or irony, humor. They show up in book titles, humorous essays, doggerel, bits of jokes and poems. So mainly they're kept alive by artificial resuscitation. They're put in life support, usually with humor attached.
So do you suppose in this age of, you know, YouTube and the Internet, that there's more of a possibility now that one of these might catch some sort of viral fire and come alive for at least a little while?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's a downside to that. It's probably true that they're more likely to catch fire at all because of the modern age and how fast things spread. But at the same time, they're also just as likely to burn out, and burn out super fast. So it's a problem. You can the last month's fad is completely forgotten, and it's the same with language. We use these things. We enjoy them for a while. They're funny for a while, and then they wear themselves out really quickly.
So speaking of fads, why is it that one form of a word sticks around forever and ever and ever, and then the other form does disappear? It falls off the map, and eventually we can't even remember what it was.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you remember where you learned most of the words that you know?
School, maybe?
Yeah, there we go. So that's the question. Most of the time, one of the things we don't have attached to most of the words that we know is where we first learned them. But when a word is put into our own lexicon, into our personal vocabulary, our idiolect, it belongs to us, and it's modified every time we use it, every time it's added to a particular person's lexicon. And in this way, they change over time. Now, some of us, let's say the great writers of the day, or the great playwrights, or the great orators, or those, or even just a professor at a university who has 500 kids a semester, right? These are people who have influence. And so their particular use of a word is more likely to be spread and is more likely to continue. And so through accidents of history, their particular idiolects become a little more standard, and they're able to spread their particular oddities. So if you have a favorite word, you ever realize that you've been using a word too much?
Oh, yes.
And, somehow it keeps coming out of your mouth? Well, now imagine that you do that every day and lots of people are listening. In that way, you can affect language change.
Well, I'm working on that on the radio right now by using unusual words every single day and seeing who listens. But, you know, we've been spending an inordinate amount of time on unkempt. What other favorites do you have?
Well, a lot of people like to ask disheveled. You know, she had disheveled hair when she rose in the morning. Disheveled is really interesting. We do tend to associate it with hair, which is amazing because disheveled part of it comes from the French word cheveux for hair. In French, they have a very similar word. It's not déchevelé. It's E-C-H-E-V-E-L-E. So they use a different negative in the front of the root, which means hair, to indicate that the hair is in disarray or out of order. But we did get it from the French, and we inherited only that form of the word from the French. You don't wake up, or you don't go to the salon and walk out with disheveled hair after having your hair done, right? So a lot of the words that we have where we don't have the pairs is because we got them from French or German or another language, and we only borrowed one half of the pair. It's kind of like adopting only one twin or only one triplet in some cases and leaving the other one for another family to take into their home.
Any very American versions of this?
I'm sorry?
Like a really American version of an unmatched word.
Oh, most of these are old. Most of these predate even the founding of the United States as a country. I don't have a particularly American one. No, I don't. There's a ton to discuss, though. I think the Americans, like the Australians, have a particular knack for playing with these archaic forms, and we like to speak in a really low slang and then throw in these fancy words once in a while just to kind of raise an eyebrow at people and say, see, I don't, you know, I'm not only about slang, I do the highfalutin talk.
So we've only got about 30 seconds left. Are there any words in it that we use now that you could see in a century or two might wind up in this category?
Oh, no, that's too much. I do want to say that one of my favorite words to talk about with unmatched pairs is ruthless, because ruthy would be a word that would mean pity, or it would mean consideration for a person's negative situation. So when you talk about ruthless, you mean lacking in pity. And I have found that people have trying to use ruthless in a non-ironic way, throwing it into the writing. She had great roots, and she cared for the children like they were her own. That's really interesting. So we may see that Ruth comes back as a new matched pair.
All right. Well, Grant, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Grant Barrett, our go-to guy for all things linguistic, also a journalist, co-host of the public radio show Away With Words.
New York Times writer Frank Bruni recently wrote that the term animal welfare doesn't capture the deepening human concern about animals anymore. Instead, he says an era of what might be called animal dignity is upon us.
Articles about the minds of cats or the emotional landscape of dogs frequently catch fire online and get passed around at massive volume. And the recent documentary Blackfish points out that it appears orcas can grieve.
Carrie Lauerman is a former editor-in-chief of Salon.com. These days he's devoting his time to the launch of a new website devoted to animals called thedodo.com. In a letter to readers, he wrote, "Those creatures big and small that have fed, frightened, entertained, comforted, and awed us are no longer just them. Increasingly, they are us." And he joins us now. Carrie, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, what did you mean when you wrote that increasingly animals are us?
Well, I do think in the last, we're kind of living through this fascinating moment now where science is kind of catching up with what, for pet owners and animal lovers, what we've suspected for a long time, which is that, showing that animals share a lot of the same cognitive abilities, social abilities that we do. And so the more and more we study them, and there has been a sort of huge increase in animal studies and animal research. I don't mean testing on animals, but actual research into how animals behave and think. That we're just learning more and more that they are very much the sort of psychic wall that we always kept between us and animals isn't that clear anymore. The boundary's not that clear.
Well, do you agree with Frank Bruni that we're now in an age of what he calls animal dignity?
Yeah, and I think every week there's a sign that that's true. We just launched the Dodo less than 5 weeks ago now. This week there's been a huge story. I mean, last week it was the giraffe in Denmark that was killed at the zoo publicly and created just a global furor. I mean, it was a story that sort of rippled across the pond at lightning speed, and there have been protests in many, major cities over it. And before that, it was the dolphin hunt in Taiji, Japan, which, had such a kind of global reaction, including from Carolyn Kennedy, the U.S. ambassador over in Japan, that the prime minister actually had to speak on it in Japan. So, I think that we're living in this kind of fascinating moment where these stories are getting bigger and bigger. And there are stories that, even 4 or 5 years ago, I think would have been, relegated to the animal welfare crowd. And now that's sort of, sort of the fringe animal rights crowd. But that seems to have gone mainstream very quickly.
When we talk about the term animal dignity, that's sort of a new term to be bandying about. What do you think that we mean when we use that term?
Well, I it's interesting. I mean, language around movements in general, I think, are interesting because, certain terms like animal rights, I think, feels too strident or too fringe for people who are mainstream, even if you've adopted these same issues, right? So I think animal dignity is a broader, more mainstream term that you have to wonder who wouldn't agree with that animals deserve to be afforded a certain amount of dignity. So I like the inclusiveness of that term for sure, and I think it's a broader, easier term for people to accept and sort of embrace than something that feels like really political or in your face.
Why do you think this is the right time to push for stories like the dodo caries, like the dolphin hunt in Japan, the stray dogs in Sochi, the minds of animals? Why are people so attuned to stories like that now and so interested and willing to, I guess, go further in what they think animals are capable of?
Yeah. Well, I mentioned the leaps that science have made, but I actually think probably a more basic reason is in most of our homes. It's the dog or the cat that we dote on. The best research I've seen has shown an increase in pet ownership of almost 40% since 1988. I think it's something like 70% of all American households have some kind of pet in them. And those are a lot more dogs and cats than there used to be. And
that explains why everyone's so nutso about all those cat videos.
Yeah. Growth of the internet has certainly helped a ton. It does explain why people are nuts. A minute ago, I was looking at this amazing video of a cat tunneling through snow, and we were joking in the office that this cat should be the icon of this winter, because we all feel like that cat. But I think the internet, the growth of the internet in that same period of time, has had a huge impact. I think in the last 3 or 4 years, talking about like the dolphin hunt or blackfish, some of these social causes that are wrapped around breaking news, I just feel like social media has sort of propelled those stories much further along than they would have in the past. They've given them sort of those afterburners that stories that are very, people feel very passionate about, really need to kind of break through to the larger media and the mainstream. So, I think the internet, like everything else, like every other part of our lives, has had a huge impact in this too.
We're talking right now with Carrie Lauerman. He's a former editor-in-chief of Salon.com, current CEO and editor-in-chief of the new animal-focused website called The Dodo.
And we'd like to hear what you think, too. Is it time to look more closely at our relationships with animals? Are animals us? Are we living in the age when animals will be afforded dignity? And are you ready to embrace that? Let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us. That address is talk@wpr.org.
Right now, we're asking whether we're entering a new age of animal dignity. People leave provisions for their pets and their wills. Animal stories routinely go viral on the internet, and scientists are pushing the envelope on what we know about animal cognition. Our guest is Carrie Lauerman, former editor-in-chief of Salon.com. He's the current CEO and editor-in-chief of the new animal-focused website called thedodo.com.
And we'd like to hear what you think, too. Do you think it's time to take a more close look at our relationship with animals? Is there a reason that all those cat videos go viral? Are we living in that age that we've been talking about when animals will be afforded dignity? Does having animals in the house change that in your mind? Join us in the discussion at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us, talk@wpr.org.
And Carrie, what do you think the world, with a changed pact between humans and animals, where animals have dignity, what does that look like? What does that world look like?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think we're beginning to see glimpses of it. I think animal testing, which has been, controversial and something that I've grown up reading about and reading about the controversy, it seems finally to be taking hold as a real social issue with a younger demographic. It's one of the few issues that seems to have steadily eroded politically. Support for has eroded over time, according to a big AP poll on morality issues last year. That's happening at the same time that the National Institutes of Health, retired 300 of its research chimps and have put a moratorium on getting new ones. So, I think it starts with, steps like that, which seem sort of logical and sensible to most of us, where Animal testing, I think, by and large, has been considered less necessary than it used to be with computer modeling and other scientific breakthroughs making that possible. But I think it also is beginning to encroach upon our lifestyle decisions. I think in Wisconsin, certainly where I'm from, I grew up in Indiana. Factory farming is a big part of life. I don't remember many dinners where we didn't have beef, maybe chicken for dinner. But I think that the issues of not just animals that are our pets, but animals that we press into entertainment and we press for food, are becoming bigger issues. You even see that. I think the most provocative way we've seen that in the last year is with the Chipotle ads, which seem, these very, fantastical, animated cartoons that Chipotle employs. And these are advertisements that are only online, but they have huge, huge viewers. In the millions, are really explicitly anti-factory farms, anti-using hormones for cows and chickens, and very aggressive and sort of pushing this kind of more humane agenda. And I think that's where I think culturally we're seeing this move more into, sort of not just treating the animals at our animals at home better or in a more informed way, but also thinking about the animals that we use in all kinds of different ways.
I want to go to our phone lines now and take Vivian in Green Bay. Hi, Vivian.
Hello. I grew up on a farm in Wisconsin, and I made a pet out of anything that would have me. had to go through the trauma of having a pet pig killed. The generation before me was very practical, of course, but when we slaughtered an animal, we did it right there on the farm. We borrowed a boiler from a co-op. The animal wasn't traumatized. It was usually a bullet to the brain as the pig was out in the pasture. I'm 68. I'm a vegetarian because of animal abuse. I can never decide if I should be happy when I see an empty cattle truck or sad. I can't tell if it's coming or going, but it's that industrial processing of the animal that bothers me. My children are also vegetarian for the very same reason. We don't eat any fish, chicken, meat. I don't condemn anyone that does. They have to get to that on their own. But in my lifetime, I've had 20 cats. I'm on my eighth dog. Had a couple horses on the farm. And animals have always had, for me, personalities and differences.
Okay, well, thank you so much for that comment, Vivian. And Vivian, sounds like she had a change of heart about the animals. She befriended them on the farm. But she does sort of get at the complexities of human relationships with animals. We can talk about animal dignity, but I imagine there will always be people who want to eat animals and animals that we use to entertain ourselves. So do you ever wonder, Carrie, how far this road can go?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And her story, I think, is very, I think a good example of the different paths people are on. Like I mentioned, I grew up in the Midwest, and I grew up a meat and potatoes person. And I think editing a site like the Dodo has made it very difficult for me to not move more aggressively toward vegetarianism. I slip now and then. I probably am more of a flexitarian, mm-hmm. which is a term being used a lot more since the New York Times writer Mark Bittman coined it. I think that probably as a culture, we're all inching into that direction, but some people much faster than others. I would be surprised if I'm not a full vegetarian. Well, I don't want to put myself on a timeline, but I just feel myself moving in that direction. But
I don't think Anthony Bourdain will ever be a vegetarian. He's the chef
who prides himself on
eating anything meat and scorning anything that's vegetarian.
He may not be on the path, but I think, but at the same time, Jean-Georges von Richten, whose name I can never pronounce fully fully appropriately, one of the most important chefs in New York, the chef of Jean Georges and Perry Street and various others, has announced he's coming out with a vegan restaurant next year. He's an American chef with very strong French influences. I mean, I've eaten at his restaurants, at least one of them, and there's a lot of meat on the menu. So, there are other people making these similar moves, but I think some people will be small incremental steps, some will be big leaps forward. But I definitely think there's a forward. You know, it's like everything else in the culture. We tend to evolve in one direction, not both or backward.
Let's take another caller now. We've got Jocelyn on the line from Sheboygan. Hi, Jocelyn.
Yes, good afternoon. This is a subject very close to my heart because I don't feel that we're really moving towards evolving as far as respecting other life on this planet. I mean, the fact that they have factory farms, and that's fairly new, and to me, just absolutely obscene. And we're still clubbing baby seals, and they call it tradition. I mean, in this state, they kill a lot of animals, which I really, really detest. And I just don't see the evolution. You know, if you have an innate respect for other life, whether flora or fauna, it's no surprise what you're talking about, because we've lived with it. I mean, I remember reading or hearing that these sadistical scientists thought that dogs didn't have any feelings, and that was in the 1960s. You know, I don't feel very optimistic about humans. I mean, there's...
Okay, let's stop there and see if we can get our guest a chance to respond. But thank you, Jocelyn. And she's questioning, has progress really been made? There's still a lot of animals, as we said, that are slaughtered for meat, and that doesn't seem likely to go away anytime soon. It's, a lot of people would argue that humans need to eat meat, in fact. So what sort of progress has been made?
Well, I feel badly that she feels that way, and she, you know, Jocelyn has good reasons to feel that way. But I think even, you know, the example that she raised about dog intelligence, that was true, you know, back in the 60s. But we're so far evolved from back then. I mean, one of the things that got me most interested in this launching the Dodo was reading the great bestseller of a few years back, Inside of a Dog, from the scientist Alexander Horowitz. And it was just this incredible research document, I can't recommend it highly enough. It's very readable, explaining what your dog is really thinking when they do the things that they do. And it's such an acknowledgement that they are beings with personalities and opinions and behaviors, you know. And that book was a gigantic bestseller. I mean, I think it sold like 4 million copies. So, you know, I do think the culture that, you know, that a book like that would have been inconceivable, you know, even 20 years ago. So I know it must be really hard to see for people who are really engaged with this issue and care so deeply. I think it's probably hard to see progress, but I definitely think, you know, we're seeing progress. It's not as quick as, you know, people like Jocelyn. Certainly I would probably like to see either, but I think it's definitely happening. And, you know, even if it's just sharing cat videos, it's you know, they're baby steps that matter.
Now, some of the changes that I've seen in my lifetime has been the move away from keeping elephants for a lot of zoos, that they're too intelligent and they have complex social societies, and zoos are thinking maybe we shouldn't keep them in these small enclosures. And now the controversy that's come up with Blackfish, that documentary about orcas and whether or not they should be kept in captivity. Could you talk a little bit about those examples and how some of the major sort of entertainment animals that we've seen, their role might be changing?
Yeah, again, I think those are two really great examples. I think, with orcas, you know, which are really at the center of the movie Blackfish, and dolphins, actually, with the dolphin hunt. There's just been so much research that, you know, has shown just how evolved they are in terms of having complex social peer groups and families and really extensive communication skills and languages. So it's become, I think, you know, what the previous caller was talking about. I mean, years ago, we would think about animals, and it wasn't just, you know, people idle talk. It was really scientists saying they don't have cognitive abilities. They don't feel pain. You know, this is actually things that we were taught. We know better now. And so, you know, particularly with orcas in captivity, elephants as well, which is a great example. There's a protest going on in New York right now about trying to keep the Ringling Brothers Circus from coming to Brooklyn. You know, these are creatures that we just know are highly evolved and incredibly intelligent. You know, they're not intelligent in the way that we are. In some ways, you know, some scientists believe that orcas in particular are capable of a sort of emotional attachment to each other that is greater than even humans. So, you know, we've just started to kind of scratch the surface of really understanding other animals' cognitive abilities. And I think that understanding is just completely changing, you know, our notions of what kind of animals we can keep in captivity. And, you know, talking about elephants and dolphins and the orcas at SeaWorld, really what we're doing to them by keeping them in captivity. I think we have a better sense of just what we're inflicting on them, and the questions, you know, are raised of whether or not we should continue doing it.
Well, Carrie, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
So fun to be on. Thanks for having me.
That was Carrie Lauerman, CEO and editor-in-chief of the new animal-focused website called thedodo.com.